will clean up all your talking in a manner such as this.
They will make you take a tinkle when you wanna take a piss.
And they'll make you call fellatio a trouser-friendly kiss.
Here's the plain situation. There's no negotiation with the fellas at the freaking FCC.
They're as stuffy as the stuffiest of special interest groups.
Make a joke about your bowels and they order in the troops.
Any baby with a brain could tell them everybody poops.
Take a tip, take a lesson. You'll never win by messing with the fellas at the freaking FCC.
And if you find yourself with some young sexy thing, you're gonna have to do her with your ding-a-ling. 'Cause you can't say penis. So they sent this little warning. They're prepared to do their worst.
And they stuck it in your mailbox, hoping you could be coerced.
I can think of quite another place they should have stuck it first.
They may just be neurotic or possibly psychotic. They're the fellas at the freaking FCC.
Hello, hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Slongcast, episode 42, for Thursday, September 22nd, 2011. I'm your host, Kevin Slonka, and with me, as always, Mr. Ryan Lancey.
Howdy.
Howdy, indeed. Should we all talk with a twang for this whole episode?
We could do that if you want.
Okay, we can do that. No, I can't do that. I cannot keep that up.
Got a little bit of consternation.
Seriously. Yeah, so what's been going on? We've both been busy. It's taken a couple weeks in between episodes.
Yeah. I mean, I stay busy at, you know, a lot of stuff around the house and all that.
Yeah, I just started back school, so that doesn't help anything. Yeah,
trying to tackle the weeds in the lawn.
Oh, weeds.
Trying to decide what to do with it.
Dude, I hate weeds.
I've read online, like, you know, if the weeds are just too bad, they just say, you know, like, nuke it. Like, you just take Roundup and just kill the whole lawn.
A friend of mine bought a Weed Begone, and then sprayed his whole yard, and that worked.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because his wife suggested it, and he's like, are you sure you want me to do this? Because it might turn into Yard Begone. but it actually worked.
Yeah, I guess there's different kinds of pesticides. Like, some of them are, like, they're non-selective, meaning they kill everything. And then there's ones that are, like, pre-emergent, which, like, just kills the seeds from the annual weeds.
Right.
Or whatever.
Yeah, so. I don't know how that crap works.
Yeah, anyway. We should start a garden hour.
We should start a garden hour. This has been Gardening Hour, brought to you by PBS. All right.
Cat.
So let's not talk about gardening, and let's talk about some tech stuff. Top story, Mike Harrington leaves TechCrunch.
What's that about?
Seriously. This is, for those who don't know, TechCrunch kind of started out of like a startup type company. He wanted to cover and invest in startups, and that's where TechCrunch came out of. And then it turned into pretty much one of the biggest tech blogs out there, covering, you know, every big company and what they do and all the sales they make and who gets hired and fired. You know, pretty much everybody in the tech world has heard of TechCrunch, and Mike Harrington was the leader of it. And recently we've had stories they've been bought by AOL. AOL was bought by the HuffPost, Arianna Huffington. There's been rumors that, you know, people didn't like working for her, blah, 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 whatever. And a lot of people are saying that this might have been Harrington getting fed up and just saying, you know what, I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
You guys told us you weren't going to stifle our journalistic integrity, and you kind of did, so I'm gone. What do you see as far as the future of TechCrunch goes without the guy who did it?
Well, you know, there's other, this sort of like consolidation among these like tech websites is starting to, it seems like it's already happened, I think, to some extent. Like, I didn't even realize this. I was a longtime Ars Technica reader, and I found out that they were bought by Condé Nast, which is like a,
really,
I guess it's like a some kind of news organization. I can't think. They actually also own Reddit now. But they broke Reddit off into like a subsidiary or something. But anyway, you know, there was sort of something a little bit like, I don't know what the word is, like entrepreneurial and sort of like cowboyish in a way of the tech media, where there's like all these different organizations. You know, like you have some of the big hitters like CNET.
It's like the Wild West.
Yeah, the Wild West. That's a good, you know, and they really hadn't, you know, while the rest of journalism had, this is not to say that there aren't journalistic standards in tech journalism, but the rest of the, you know, journalism world, I think had more standards, or, you know, there was a lot of uncharted territory in the tech industry.
Oh, well, blogging in general, you know, started with tech stuff, and that was just new. Like, there were no standards for that.
Yeah. You know? I mean, there's certain things, you know, like, you know, you should have sources for your material, and, you know, I'm not a journalist. I mean, we do this for fun, but
right.
Like, I'm not a journalist by any means. And it just seems like the tech industry the tech journalism industry wasn't quite as like rigid as the rest of journalism.
Oh, it clearly wasn't.
So I'm sure this is somewhat a case of like banging heads. That said, it could be something else entirely. But, you know, I've heard like Leo Laporte and others take issue with Arrington's coverage of companies that he invests in. But he focuses, or not, I don't know if he focuses, but he definitely just has. You know, he has information about the his investments and the companies.
Here's the thing with Arrington, like, you know, Leo and all those guys, they don't invest in companies that they cover because they want to try to remain neutral. But by remaining neutral, they also don't have any inside information. Whereas Arrington, you know, the way TechCrunch was, they talked and helped startups. So, you know, Dig, Twitter, all these big companies. So Arrington got in, gave him money, you know, invested in their company, and because of that, got to know the people who ran it, got all this inside information. He was able to cover it a lot more. Mm-hmm. Was his opinion inserted in his articles? Probably.
Yeah.
But he had information nobody else did because of it.
Yeah, I wonder how that works with like insider trading and that sort of stuff. Like,
yeah.
Like if it's not listed on the SEC, I don't think it on a stock exchange and governed by the SEC.
Right. If there's no IPO.
Then. Yeah. I don't know that it really matters, but, you know, in some ways, like you could say, well, if you don't cover the startups that you invest in, you may be like hiding it. Like in a way, like, you know, like how would this work? Like you could give bad press to their competitors and no one ever knows that you're invested
right.
in the competitors to that. So it's like, well, I could see it both ways.
Right. So somebody like Arrington could have written all these articles of how MySpace sucks and how Google Plus sucks, but nobody would have realized he invested in Facebook.
Right.
Yeah.
But exactly.
I mean, that just, this whole thing calls into question, you know, human integrity, and that right. you basically just have to trust somebody because right. there's no way to know.
Yeah. Because there's, I'd say in some ways I almost prefer Arrington's method because, and I'm not a huge fan of his, but I just think that like the only way that you know somebody is invested in a competitor to a technology is if they cover that technology that they invested in. If they don't, then you never know they're an investor in it.
Yeah.
Unless they just happen to mention it.
Yeah, I have no problem with the way he did things. I mean, if he would have hidden it, like you said, that's a problem, but he didn't hide anything. You know, if he covered Microsoft, he would tell you, hey, I am an angel investor in Microsoft. You know, he wouldn't hide anything, so I had no problem. I think TechCrunch, I've already seen I've seen more articles show up from TechCrunch than before, and they seemed lesser quality. I don't know if you noticed that on any of the articles coming out from TechCrunch, but there were more articles covering things that you wouldn't necessarily think TechCrunch would cover, like smaller little things.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like there's also been a big change, you know, once he left in what they cover. So I guess, you know, it's fairly recent, so we still have yet to see what's going to happen with them. But another top news is Windows 8 has been released. So you had a couple articles about that.
Yeah. The first one was just a blog entry on the Building Windows 8 blog from Steven Sinofsky. And I don't know if we've covered this blog at all on the show, but it's really informative.
We've had articles from it, but we've never mentioned what it was.
Yeah, if you want to know about what's going on behind the scenes with the development of Windows 8, and it's probably a pretty rosier picture of the development process, you know, this is a great blog. It's if you go to blogs.msdn.com, I think it's like /B/B8 or something like that. And that's the blog. But just search for building Windows 8 on Google. You'll find it. In this entry, though, Sanofsky, you know, talks about that the fact that they're releasing the development preview of Windows 8.
Oh, so it's not like a final beta or anything. It's...
No. There's still probably, by my estimates, this is just what I, from experience in the past, I'd say probably 6 months away from a beta.
Oh, okay.
And probably 9 months away from a release candidate, and probably a year away from a full.
So we're looking into next year.
They're saying fall, like early fall. They want to get well in before the Christmas season.
Get it on computers.
And they're saying actually maybe even before they're targeting for, you know, release manufacturing early enough that it would make it onto the school year or the school back to school season.
That would be good because also it's about time for Apple. Well, next year will be about time for Apple to refresh their computers right before school starts.
Yeah. So. And I say a year, but probably more like 10 months. You know, like, so maybe shave 2 months off all those or something like that. Maybe like 2-3 months away from a beta and 5 months or, you know,
right.
so away.
So
from,
about this time next year.
Yeah. I'd say about this time next year or a little bit earlier. And this is really cool. They released it at their Build conference, which is a like gathering of like over 5,000 Microsoft developers.
I had never heard of that conference before.
I don't know if they renamed it. If it might, maybe used to be called the Microsoft Developers Conference or something. I don't know. But they released it at Build, and you know, they made available all of the ISOs for download. You can get a 32-bit, a 64-bit version, and then also another version that has the developer tools baked into it. So you can, it has like a version of Visual Studio that's sort of customized for that. I think it's like pared down a little bit and mainly just...
Well, probably like the free one that anybody could get.
Except
with all that Windows 8 APIs.
Right, it has all the Windows 8 APIs in it. Although I think you can get the Windows 8 APIs or SDK already for Visual Studio 2010.
Nice.
But you'd need a build of Windows to test these on because this is mainly geared towards, at least I think the version of Visual Studio that's built baked into the developer version, it's about the Metro apps. And if you haven't heard of Metro, that's their Microsoft's new tile-based interface that they used on Windows Phone 7. It's gotten great reviews. It's really, I would call it, I won't even use the word innovative. I just think it's a revolutionary change in the interface to computers.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you. Since you downloaded it, you've obviously played with it on a machine. What do you think of the Metro interface? Like, what would make somebody want to use that rather than click the button to go back to old style?
Well, there's a couple reasons. One, old style in Windows 8 isn't quite old style. Like, so there's still, at least in the version... Well, it's hard.
You can only talk about the version you've seen.
Yeah, it's hard to break this down. The version I've seen, you know, when you click the desktop, it takes you back to like something that looks a bit like Windows 7 or Vista desktop. You know, with the same sort of arrow theme and you know the
icons
that sort of But there's really no icons on your desktop. Like, I guess you could store files there if you wanted, like if you wanted to have some like documents and that sort of thing. But it's not, you can't launch programs from it from what I can tell. There's no start menu. Like when you click the start button in the desktop interface, it takes you back to the Metro interface.
So what's the point of going back to old style then?
There really isn't. they really want people to switch to this. This is sort of like, and this is why I said it's revolutionary. This is sort of like the jump from, it's almost, I'd say it's maybe even bigger than the jump from Windows 3.1 to Windows 95.
The whole new interface.
Yeah, it's completely different. Now, I don't know that Windows 95 was any better than Windows 3.1 in terms of interface. It was better for other reasons. The start menu, it was better at organizing things, but really what ended up happening is your groups in Windows 3.1 just became folders in your start menu.
Right.
I mean, essentially is what happened. And yeah, you threw a couple things on your desktop, but that was really no different than like the default group that used to come up in Windows 3.1. So, you know, there was, this is, we're talking, you know, this is what, 15, 16 years ago now.
This is elementary school for me.
Yeah. I mean, some people may not even be familiar with Windows 3.1 that are listening, but
if you're not, you should go download it and play with it.
Yeah. Get yourself a virtual box and throw FreeDOS on it. And
exactly. Install it.
Just so you can experience. But anyway, this change is big. You know, it's the start menu is now the Metro interface, essentially. Now, from what I've read, there are some registry hacks that can get you back into the classic desktop.
Oh, forget about those.
Yeah. Well, and this is something like, you know, Paul Thurrott commented that, you know, back when Windows 95 came out, the power users wanted the old 3.1 file manager interface.
And that was a registry hack.
There was a registry hack to get that as your default thing to open up. And hey, I did it too, because it's what I knew when I was like, you know, 15 years old,
right,
or 14 years old at the time. And I think that people will do that, but that's not what they recommend. You know, they want this to be the interface. And I think, you know, the new Windows 8 computer specification is going to include things like touch screens. I don't know if they'll be mandatory, but I think they should be, and or very highly recommended.
Right.
Other than for things that just doesn't make sense on. The interface is just wild. I mean, it is, you want to touch your screen, and I don't have a touchscreen computer to test it on.
You're like, why doesn't this work?
Yeah. Actually, I mean, it'd be interesting. I have a Honeycomb tablet. It has an ARM processor in it.
Put it on.
You know, there might be a way to load, this is their thing. From what I know, none of the classic features of Windows will be available in the ARM version. It will just be the Metro interface.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. They're sort of going this like one solution to rule them all type thing,
right.
But it'll break down depending on if you're running ARM or x86.
So last thing about the interface before we hit your next article talking about a potential problem, what did you think about full screen apps? Because from what I've heard before, whenever you open an app, it goes full screen, and that's how you use the Metro interface.
It is full screen. However, there are ways to sort of multitask still. Okay, there's a thing called a sidebar docked state where you can, if the app developer chooses to support it, which they have like, you know, application guidelines, standards like that, you can like sort of drag a window in and like snap it to the left or right side in like a, I don't know, like a one-third, two-third view sort of thing, where one-third is the one application and two-thirds is the other application. So you can sort of like, you know.
So you have two open at the same time. Then.
Right.
Okay.
And you can still run normal Windows apps back in the desktop environment. You know, so you could just click the desktop and like classic Word would run in there if you wanted.
Okay.
Now they're coming out with a version of Word and or Office for Metro.
Right.
So you probably won't need it, you know.
Well, the thing that gets me about that is like, you know, on an iPad or any handheld touch device, full screen isn't a problem because you have finger gestures, you can swipe back and forth between applications very fast. But on a computer, a non-touch computer like what most people have now, if you have only full screen apps, like how do you switch with the mouse? Is that easy?
There's actually like sort of like gestures for the mouse too. Okay. Like if you take the mouse pointer and like move it over to the edge of the screen and like let it hover there for like, I don't know, like it seemed like half a second.
Right.
A little window pops up, and if you click it, the previous app like shuffles into view. But
so it shows you what's coming up next, kind of.
Right. And if you keep your mouse there, so like you click, as soon as it shuffles into view, the one previous to that shows up. So
okay.
Like you can like quickly like flip through a bunch of apps.
Right.
And then that's a swipe gesture, you know, for the touch screens.
Right.
But I think touch screens are going to become pervasive. The way I actually see this going after I used it is, and this is sort of from a little bit of use of my Honeycomb tablet. My Honeycomb tablet has a keyboard and touchpad dock. What I find is that I use the keyboard to type when I need to type, but I use the touchscreen for everything else. So I think we're going to see mice and trackpads go by the wayside. That's my prediction.
I can definitely see that because I hear a lot of people say whenever they give their kids, like they start their kids on iPads, iPhones, Android phones, whatever has a touch interface, and then their kids get old enough, the parents try to let them use the computer, they immediately go and finger up the monitor because they think that's how it should work.
Well, right. I mean, and it is pretty intuitive after you've done it that way.
Right. So it seems like that's the way everything should go because that's what people think.
The huge, huge downside, in my opinion, with touch is that you finger up your screen.
Yeah.
This is something that they need to work on. I don't know if it's the material that they put on the screen. Or if it's, instead of touching it, you just get really close to the monitor. Like maybe it's sort of like a motion camera type thing.
Yeah. I don't know how Android stuff works, but like Apple claims they're oleophobic coating, you know, scared of oil coating. And it is really easy to get oil off of, you know, if you have a, you can rub it on your shirt and it comes off. I don't know if yours does that.
I mean, I keep a microfiber cloth.
I do too, yeah.
And it, one swipe and all the fingerprints are gone.
Right, but still, it sucks.
Yeah, it's just a pain in the ass to have to deal with.
Yeah.
I mean, first world problem, right?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Where's my filet mignon and my microfiber?
Yeah.
So what's this, your next article points out a problem that some people might see with Windows 8.
Well, yeah, so... Part of Windows 8 spec is that it's going to support UEFI, which I don't think that it has to have a UEFI. Let's talk about UEFI. The replacement for the BIOS in a computer or the next generation, it was EFI. EFI really didn't catch on. It was used in Apple systems. It's used in Itanium systems. And a couple other motherboards support it, but a lot of them just have it disabled and they boot up to a classic BIOS anyways. UEFI is the next evolution of that. I think it. I can't remember what it stands for. Unified, I think. Unified.
EFI is the extensible firmware interface.
Yeah, and I think the U is unified or something like that.
I will look it up while you talk.
Anyway, Windows 8 is going to support UEFI. So if your computer has it,
Unified Extensible Firmware Interface.
Okay, I thought I looked it up before, and that's what it. But anyways, if your computer supports it. There's a thing called secure boot where there's a signature put on the, on the OS, and the UEFI will only allow something with a valid signature. Like, I guess it has to have a signature and then match, like it calculates it or something. And that way, you know, you prevent yourself again from vulnerabilities to a boot kit, you know, like a virus that installs in the bootloader.
And that's really the next haven. Like, we've had rootkits for a while, and now attackers are going to go after the BIOS and stuff you can't detect.
Right. So this is a way of preventing that. I think part of it is they've done this is because UEFI is, I think, maybe more vulnerable to bootkits in a sense that, you know, it's not just...
It's extensible.
Well, it's extensible. There's a lot more code. You can do a lot more in that environment versus BIOS, which is really, really limited and very hard to program in. From what I've read, I've never actually done it. But anyways, the tragedy here is that most Linux distros, probably current ones, don't have signatures made.
I want to read more about this signature thing like that.
Yeah, they say that basically you have to be able to pay for one sort of like from the certifying. I think I don't know if this is an RSA thing or
so
not.
So it's kind of like the Windows valid drivers where you have to pay Microsoft to certify your stuff. You get a driver and you don't get the pop-up.
Yeah, and I don't think this is strictly a Microsoft thing.
Well, like, right. I was just
everyone's blaming Microsoft for this, but this is something that's supported in the EFI standard, I guess, which is something co-developed by Intel and probably a lot of other industry partners, Apple being one of them because they use it.
Right.
But the point here, I guess, is that that if Windows detects that the secure boot function is turned off, which you can do, and then that would allow Linux to boot, it would prevent Windows from booting then. So to switch between Linux and Windows on the same machine, you have to like not only have a bootloader, you have to switch the secure mode on and off in the UEFI, the secure boot mode.
Wow, this is ridiculous because they're saying like if you want to boot Linux, you have to have a bootloader that is GPL version 3 because only version 3 requires signing keys.
Well, this
is going to be crap.
That's if you go the signed route where if you leave the secure boot mode on.
Right. Yeah.
And the Linux installation is signed, then you would need to use GPL v3. But what the other option is, you just turn secure boot mode off and then you should be able to boot from Linux. So it's not a total prevent, it's just a hassle. Because to flip between the two, you'll need to toggle that secure boot mode.
And hopefully, like, the nice thing about with the way Macs do it, I've never used any other machine that uses EFI or UEFI, but with the way Macs are, let me first talk about how BIOS works. Everybody knows when they want to boot from a CD or a floppy, you have to turn it on, press F2, get into the BIOS, change your boot order, reboot. with the EFI, the way Apple does it, if you want to boot from a CD-ROM, you hold the letter C when you turn your computer on. If you want to boot from the network, you hold the letter N, or you know, yeah, something like that. I don't know if that's a base EFI thing, but if it is, that is awesome. And I wonder if they can just make a hotkey for this signed boot or not signed boot.
Yeah, they might be able to, or maybe you could like get a custom EFI, or you know, who knows. I mean, this really only affects people that dual boot. That's really what I think it comes down to. So they're making it out to be a huge, huge issue. I don't dual boot. I used to. Computers are cheap. If you want a Linux machine, just go buy another box. Yeah,
$400, $300.
Or something used. I mean, it's like, you know, if, I don't know. I don't see a reason to have to switch. File compatibility, drive compatibility, you know, Linux sort of supports it all now.
Yeah, there's no problems. I just recently, my hard drive and my server died. Yesterday, I went to Best Buy, bought a new hard drive, downloaded the Fedora 15, the newest ISO, put it in. Everything just worked. Like, I have a 1920 by 1200 monitor. I used to have to go find drivers for it. Now, everything just picks it up. Everything works. Printer's installed. Like, everything, bam, right off the bat. It's like there's no problems anymore with running other OSs.
Yeah, and plus, like, you know, I just don't see a need to dual boot. I mean, yeah, I guess you can, and you might want
to.
Yeah,
I don't.
And I'm sorry for the people that really want to do that. But, you know, Microsoft is looking for a way to prevent, you know, boot kit attacks. And I don't know. If they have a better method, then, you know, someone else said, well, this just allow the user to toggle that off and on. And who knows? Maybe it'll be like a registry switch or a configuration
I don't think they'll do that, because if they do, then that leaves it open to attack. You get malicious software that makes the toggle and then reboots your system and bam.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, if they do that, there's huge problems. Like, they can't do that.
But still, no matter what, there'd have to be some sort of code in there, so you could just replace a DLL or something. You know?
The code would have to be in the BIOS, and you would have to the EFI, and you would have to toggle it by rebooting, entering the EFI config, and toggling there.
Oh. Like,
you got to keep it away from the OS, is my point.
Well, but there's two parts to it. Like, one is that So would Windows install something into the EFI? Is that how it works?
That's what I don't know about the signing thing. I was trying to read it as you talked, but I didn't. Somebody made mention of, like, they'd have to, even if Linux distros self-sign, then they would still have to send their keys out to every OEM to get it included in the EFI. So it seems like Microsoft has to make the keys for Windows 8 and then give it to Award BIOS or you know, whoever makes EFI.
Yeah,
firmware, and have them included in the burn of the chip.
Oh, I see. So the keys are in there.
Yeah.
That's weird.
At least that's what the article said. Whether it's going to work like that or not, I don't know.
Yeah.
Either way, I mean, it's brand new, so I'm sure we'll see more articles in the future on this.
Yeah, I don't even know if they have it completely figured out yet, like what exactly the problems are.
So. I mean, if we're coming up with problems for it, I doubt they have it figured out.
Yeah.
So our next article, talking about Microsoft again, I didn't even realize this until I saw this article. Apparently, Bing is like the worst thing ever. Like, it is bleeding $1 billion. They just keep losing and losing and losing and losing money year after year.
Yeah, I think it's $1 billion total, right?
Microsoft has lost $5.5 billion on Bing since it launched in 2009.
Wow.
But the company's search losses actually predate that. A total of $9 billion in search is what Microsoft has lost.
Wow.
You like Bing, right?
I do. I think there's some things that it does better. You know, I'm sure they're mostly things that, you know, Google just add. But there were some things I thought early on that were pretty innovative. I mean, I really like the Bing home screen, namely because every day I see something new and I like, they give you stuff to click on and you can learn about it. Like, Google just doesn't do that. I mean, it's not what I went to Google for in the first place to learn, but it's just something I like about Bing. It's sort of like a fringe benefit. You know, I don't use it exclusively. I use both search engines.
I was going to ask, since you liked it better than Google, if you had any insight into why it's losing so much money. You know, like, do you see, as a user of it, do you see anything wrong that just makes people go, screw this, I'm going to Google?
Well, it's interesting that they put it this way, you know, that it loses money. Because, like, if you think about Google, for instance, and, you know, they don't make money on search. They make money on advertising.
Right.
So they invest lots of money into search technologies, and they make up for it on the advertising end. Now, they use their search information to help pay the bills, you know, or to get the data they need to do good advertising. So I guess I don't know how I didn't read this in detail.
I was gonna say I guess your question is more how did they come up with these numbers? Are they saying that it loses because Microsoft has so many people who they pay so much money to develop Bing and there's no return from Bing, only advertising? But if Google would have done the same report, they would have shown a $9 billion loss too, because Google search does nothing. It's the advertising that does it. Like, you know, how were these numbers come up with?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I just don't know how they come at these, you know, up with these. Because what, you know, Google makes money through advertising. That's all, you know, and their search engine isn't the only driver of that advertising. Like, I have a feeling that a lot of their advertising is done in different ways. Like people pay for their demographic information. You know, I don't even know all the details. But
I mean, now Google Wallet was just released for the Nexus S. So people using that, I'm sure there's going to be targeted ads and all kinds of crap to.
Yeah, you know, interesting note on that, like that data that you get from, I guess, Borders in the bankruptcy case. They part of the one of the things they have for sale is the customer data.
Is that allowed?
Well, I guess, you know, they even have agreements they wouldn't share their data with, like, third parties. But in the bankruptcy, it's, like, an asset, so they can sell it to somebody else.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think Barnes & Noble was, like, bidding for it.
Aren't there laws against this?
Yeah.
That is crazy.
Anyways.
Yeah, so talking about companies screwing up, seems that Netflix has decided, you know, we're done. Not in a way that they're just quitting. They're saying, we don't like having a streaming service and a deliver-to-your-door DVD service. So they split up into two companies. Netflix will only be online streaming, and a new company called Quickster, Q-W-I-K-Stir, will be the ones that deliver DVDs to your door. Again, you know, just like the last article, I don't understand, you know? Like, what's the deal?
Well, Netflix is in a lose-lose situation.
Really?
And here's why. Right now, they're just a middleman. All the movie studios have to do is make an iPad app for each of their, for each studio.
Funny you say that. I just downloaded TBS, TNT, and PBS.
Yeah.
But the problem with that is you can only watch what is currently on air.
Well, yeah, they do that. But the movie studios could be like, want to watch any movie from our history of movies? Here you go. And all they have to do is pretty much support Windows, Android, and Apple. I mean, literally three applications they need to write. And they will cover 99.5% of the market.
Or here's this. Make a H.264 website, and then you support everybody instantly.
Yeah. Because Netflix streaming, anybody that does Netflix streaming, they're using a computer or a Roku box. I think with Roku, like, it's not only Netflix, right? Like, it could support.
It's other things, too.
Yeah, like, so they could make a, you know, Roku adapter or something. So, we haven't even tapped into the, you know, online movie distribution market. It's probably, like, I don't know, maybe this is a total guess, because I actually haven't looked into it, but I'd say it's probably only, at most, 20% of the market of movie rentals. Because people still go to the movie store, or Redbox, or...
Redbox is big.
Yeah, they still might use the DVD service of Netflix. Since everybody's moving towards streaming anyways, I just don't think DVDs are sustainable in the long run.
So, yeah, that part of their business I can see getting rid of.
It's probably the one that's making money right now, but I think that's mainly because of the pricing structure that the studios have put on them. I don't know. I mean, I was a Netflix customer, like, way back, like, when it first started. Whenever they had service in Johnstown,
like when they were only DVDs,
yeah, I had it. We're talking like 2000.
Oh, wow.
1999 or something like that. Like, it was right after it had come out. And I had it for a summer, which is a bad time to get a movie service because in summer you don't watch, you know, you're outside. But anyway, I liked them back then. I thought they provided a valuable service. But, you know, I over the years I lost interest with it and I just didn't rent as many movies. I hate to see them go, but I think this is just the writing on the wall.
Yeah, you bring up a good point with, you know, all the movie studios and television stations have to say is no, and they're done. But, you know, for the longest time, it seemed like we had always thought Netflix was like the unsung hero. Like, they're going to come along and negotiate these contracts and give us everything from every movie studio and every television station. You know, we thought they were going to come along and make people change. And they really haven't. I mean, have you heard anything about the original series that they were supposed to be coming out with?
Yeah, I remember mention of that, but
it was like a Kevin Spacey thing, you know, so big names.
Well, that's in my opinion, that's stupid because they're going to compete with their customers or
right.
their clients, I guess.
Their affiliates.
Their affiliates, yeah. Whatever you want to call them. Or, you know, they're competing, they become competition for the people they're buying product from.
Right.
And that just seems like they would be like, okay, fine, we won't sell to you. We'll make our own app. Like, there's no reason that Warner Brothers couldn't just, like, hire another company to do all the stuff that Netflix does
right.
and distribute their movies. Now, do they want to handle, like, 5 million credit card accounts? Probably not. But guess what? That's what the Apple App Store's for.
Right.
You know? It all goes through the App Store, and you get payments, checks right from Apple.
But then again, you know, even though I didn't like having to download 3 apps for 3 different stations. I would have loved to be able to download one app and have everything there.
Yeah.
You know, if it goes this way, I don't want an app for every television station. I don't want an app for Lionsgate and MGM and every movie studio that's out there. Like, that's going to be ridiculous if that's the way it goes.
Well, what Apple can do is just say, well, okay, we'll just be your Netflix. I mean, because really right
now... I mean, we need somebody to be
Netflix and Apple are like competitors, essentially, in the streaming world.
They are.
So it's definitely an interesting time. I mean, I do think streaming has a future, but I think if they don't play their cards right, they're just going to... The studios are just going to go like direct right through an app.
Yeah. So you actually submitted a first Mac article, and people don't know because they can't read our email, but us two and a couple other people actually had a fairly long email conversation/argument because some of us, my hand is in the air, didn't completely read the article. But tell us about this huge problem.
So I found this article. I had been following the OS X Lion release since I read about a bug in their LDAP authentication with the first release of Lion, and then a subsequent patch, I guess that was 10.7.1, didn't fix it. And I don't know that they're planning to fix it. And that problem was with the you can basically log in as like any user. Like, once the system's authenticated via LDAP, then any user can log in as any user, like any valid user account, no password or just a junk password.
It'll just accept it anything.
Just accept it. And I don't know if they fixed that yet or not. So I saw this other one, so it piqued my interest. And this one is related to cracking OS X user account passwords.
Local user accounts, not directory ones, right?
Yeah. And what was interesting is that basically where they store the hashes was available to any user on the system. And then the person, since they're available, the person has access to the hashes, and you can run a brute force on the hash pretty easily. But in addition to that, you can call the password change the thing to change somebody's password and just put a new hash in there for whatever password you want, since you have access to the file. And
yeah, I'm actually trying this. If you notice I'm quiet, I'm making a user and trying out these commands that are in the article to see if this actually happens. Because I didn't get a chance to try this beforehand. This was actually the problem that came up in the email that I brought up. I'm like, you know, this doesn't make sense. User information is public on a machine. If you have access to the machine, then you have access to this data. It's no big deal. And apparently I didn't read the article correctly.
Yeah, he says here, like, he's, you know, this is a quote. He says, now, if the password is not found by a dictionary file, you're out of luck, right? Well, no. Why crack a hash when you can just change it the password directly? It appears directory services in line is no longer requires authentication when requesting a password change for the current user. So in order to change the password of a currently logged in user, simply use DSCL localhost dash password slash search slash user slash Bob. And then you're able to change their password. So I guess they have to be currently logged in, though.
Well, I just tried. What I did, I made a new user account mm-hmm. called Test. It's not an administrator. I opened up a terminal and sued to Test. So I became Test. And then I ran this command to read from the local directory of my personal user account that I always use, which is an administrator. And yeah, it came back and gave me the hash.
Nice.
So I have the password hash from a non-admin account. So yeah, it looks like I don't actually, you know what? I'm going to reset my password to what it always was. Actually, I'm going to make, no, I don't want to make Test administrator. I'm going to probably F up my machine, but I want to see if this works.
Yeah.
So in order to change the password, you can simply run this command. So directory services command line, localhost dash pass WD slash and the path to my user, search users sloncac, and voila, you will be prompted to enter a new password without the need to authenticate. So let's see if the Test user can reset my sloncac's password. New password. Do. Permission denied.
It's interesting.
So this guy lies. So maybe this would be the case if the user that did it was an admin on the box. But that kind of goes back to my point that I was arguing over email. If you're an admin on the box, you have free reign anyways. So I don't know. I mean, you can see new password. I entered it. It immediately said permission denied. Please enter the user's old password. So in order to change Sloncac's password, Test would have to know Sloncac's password. So I'm going to control C so I don't kill my own account. Yeah, so...
Interesting. Well, anyway.
Apparently this isn't a problem.
Well, you can still get the hash.
You can still get the hash.
And do a dictionary attack on
yes,
it.
Yes, you can get the hash and you can crack. That is a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, because even like one of the points I brought up before was that, you know, in Active Directory, say you're on a corporate domain, all that is public information. Everything in the directory is public information. You can, you know, formulate the correct LDAP command and go out and get anything about any user. You can't get the password. In this case, you can get a hash and, yeah, try to crack it. So that's still a problem. And like I said before, that's, I keep saying like I said before, like everybody listening to this knows what I said before. So as I had originally thought, this could probably be done with a simple patch that just chmods the password hash files. They're basically the shadow files, makes it so it's only readable by the owner, and then you're good to go. So like a one-line update. But there's still that open LDAP problem.
Yeah.
So we'll see if Apple fixes any of that. Moving on, you've probably been wondering for this whole time, what was the deal with the opening Family Guy song that talks about the freaking FCC? Well, they're actually talking about censoring TV, but in our next article from Hot Hardware, all of those net neutrality rules that we've been talking about for the past year, actually it has been about a year, they will be going into effect about September. I'm sorry, December. So, And it's not going to be as big of a deal as people think it is. You know, it's basically going to prevent throttling. It's going to... But here's the thing. So all the cool stuff that we wanted to happen is going to happen.
Right.
So awesome. But there is still a loophole where ISPs can accept paid prioritization. So while they can't throttle, somebody or some company could pay to have their data faster.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of the same thing.
So they can just make you pay for the privilege of not having torrent traffic throttled.
I'm wondering if that's what the loophole could do.
Yeah.
Because the way it was written in the article is that Comcast could pay ISPs to let their traffic go faster. But the ISPs, might be able to exploit that and make customers pay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's not cool.
No, it's not.
That's not cool at all. So expect that to go into effect very soon, within the next couple months. It was only passed by a 3-2 vote, which is kind of weird. Like, you think everybody would have been on this. So our next article, crazily enough, from Fizorg. I don't know what they're doing with an article like this. But Google Plus is no longer in private beta. They are now in public beta. So anybody, you don't need an invite anymore. Go sign up for Google Plus. Both of us have been using it for a while. What do you think so far?
Well, one thing I'm really disappointed in with Google Plus is that the Honeycomb app for Google Plus is really lacking, in my opinion.
See, that's weird, because the iOS app is crap, and the app for Android phones, not Honeycomb, the other versions, is so much better. Like, that's weird that the Honeycomb version wouldn't.
I think the one they give you for Honeycomb is just the phone one, you know.
Oh, okay.
But it doesn't take advantage of Honeycomb, like, in any way, shape, or form. I mean, it does what it does, but it's, I don't know, like, the status updates aren't real, you know, they're not real fancy. You expected more for a tablet app. I did, yeah. I just expected more for a tablet app, especially for a product like Google Plus where they're really pushing it. But
yeah, so that kind of comes in with our next article, is that there was a big change to Facebook in the past day, two days. And so with that big change, you know, with all changes, everybody hates Facebook for a couple weeks. But what do you think is going to happen to Google Plus now that Google Plus mysteriously goes into open beta the same day that Facebook changes things and pisses people off?
Yeah, I know some people on you know, like, friends of mine, they're like, see ya, I'm going to Google Plus. And
I've gotten so many new Google Plus friend circle requests or whatever in the past 2 days.
Yeah, I got a few, not a whole hell of a lot, but
compared to what I used to get, like, one a week, maybe.
Yeah, I got like four in one day or something.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's, I don't know. I don't like Google Plus enough to use it completely. I hate the home feed. And now, might as well talk about Facebook. Facebook's new home feed is just like the Google Plus home feed.
Yeah, they made it very, very, very similar, where, like, the stories you've interacted with are now, like, at the top. They're, like, integrated in the same feed instead of, like, most recent and, like, most popular.
And it's not even, at least with Google Plus, you know how the stream is going to show. It's going to show in chronological order, with the exception of more active posts move to the top.
Yeah.
On Facebook, it shows in chronological order, except then they throw in these weird categories, stories from the past 7 minutes, stories from the past half hour, stories from yesterday,
and then what's
more popular stories.
What's with that thing that's on the right now, too? Have you seen that?
Yes, so what used to be in the normal feed, you used to see this person commented on this person's status, this person commented on this photo. All comments now show up in that ticker.
Yeah.
You don't see comments anymore in the feed. You see it in the ticker. Only status updates and pictures show up in the feed.
And there was a funny, like, little, like, internet meme thing going around with, like, a picture of Exhibit.
Yeah.
And it said, like, we put a Facebook in your Facebook so you can Facebook while you Facebook.
Yeah, we put a ticker up in the right-hand corner so you can Facebook while you Facebook.
Yeah.
That was hilarious.
I like that. It was pretty
funny.
I
believe it started with, yo, dog. Yeah, so did you hate the new layout as much as I did?
I was just like, it was like slow and real buggy the first day I used it. And I'm just, I don't know what it is about Facebook, but I'm like the first person to get access to these features. Actually, have you gotten the new, has Amazon pushed the new Amazon site to you yet?
I haven't looked at it in the past couple of days.
I got it about 2 weeks ago.
What is it? What do they change?
It's just like a tablet-friendly interface.
Oh,
now.
No, I haven't seen that.
But it's coming up. It's going to be their new, I shouldn't say tablet, it's touch-friendly.
Right, right.
But it's going to be the main interface, and I can show it to you. It's way different. But like, I seem to be the first for certain people to get the, like, Google, I'm never the first. But for Amazon and Facebook, I like always get the feature like really early.
Yeah, that's weird, because with Facebook messages, like whenever they combine messages and chat, I got that like a month before anybody I knew got it.
Yeah.
And now with the new stream, like, I know people who have had it for a couple weeks and I just saw it yesterday.
Yeah. I got I got that pretty late, the integrated, what is it, messages and chat.
Yeah.
But then I got that chat sidebar thing. That's a pain in the... I never see that. How do you...
I guess you only see that if you have like a maximized window or a wide window. Like if it detects your window is wider than the 1024. Because I don't get that.
I only get it... I don't get it on the tablet. Well, it depends on what I set the browser string to on the tablet. Right. But if I don't get it in tablet mode, but I do get it on desktop. So it's weird.
Yeah, I've never... I'll have to maximize my window and see if it pops over there. Because I still have the old... have to minimize, you know, chat bar at the bottom thing.
Yeah.
It's weird. I hate Facebook.
Me too.
I hate Google Plus too, so it doesn't matter. So we're going to end the show with two mobile stories. The first one is actually kind of pissing me off because I was planning on the iPhone 5 coming out. I was planning on it being LTE on Verizon, and I was planning on dumping the crap out of AT&T and jumping to Verizon. Well, now PC Mag spits out an article that says, yeah, you might want to wait a little bit because AT&T just released their LTE in select cities, and it's like 30 times faster. It's like twice as fast, seriously this time, twice as fast as Verizon's LTE. And a friend of mine commented on my Facebook post complaining about this, that Sprint is going to come out with even faster LTE than these two very soon. So now I don't know what to do.
Here's the thing. This is total BS in my opinion, because they're measuring a loaded down 4G system that's been released for almost a year now versus AT&T have just switched it on 3 days ago and don't even sell an LTE phone, or they might have like one.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
So there's no one using the LTE bandwidth. And I know for a fact that the throughput for a tower is, it's like in there, the throughput for any of these systems, like, you know, when they say, you know, LTE or you know, whatever HSPDA 40 is 42 megabytes, that's like the maximum theoretical possible speed.
Right. That's like saying Ethernet is 100 megabits. You're never going to get it.
Right. You're not. But it's even more like saying Ethernet's 100 megabits and you're on a hub and not a switch. Because then it's aggregate, like, you know, you share that among all the clients.
Right.
It's the same way. There's only so much, like maybe like if you have 10 clients on the tower, like you all get like pretty good speed. But as more and more people get on the tower, it's going to go down. It's still faster than 3G, much faster, a lot faster.
Right.
But as people get on the system, it's going to go down a bit. And these numbers are just now. It could be. I'll admit, it could be that that AT&T put in faster backhaul. Maybe the fiber to their towers is faster, but it may not matter. Like you may, in like a long shot, may be able to get 42 megabits from AT&T, but you'll only ever be able to get 20 from Verizon, no matter what, because they put in 20 megabit connections to the towers.
And here's my argument that I made while talking to somebody about this, kind of arguing against my complaint, is that, sure, Verizon LTE is 16 megabits and AT&T is 25. You're only going to be browsing websites that can at best give you 3.
Yeah.
You will never know the difference. If you're on a laptop where you can multitask downloads and crap like that, yes, you will know the difference. If you're on a phone, you will never, ever, ever know the difference.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is going to help. You know, when you're streaming a bunch of files at once, or you're downloading a file, so like I'm sure like app installs might happen a lot faster.
Right.
But you know what? There's a theoretical maximum to the amount of data that can even be processed by those little smartphones.
I was going to say the ARM processor can only handle so much.
Yeah, because I've actually noticed, like, with when I switched to my BlackBerry on my first smartphone, which is like a Windows phone, It never, Wi-Fi was never faster than 3G. Like, it just wasn't, like, and it was mainly because the pocket PC phone I had, the Windows phone, was limited. Like, it just couldn't move any faster than it moved. But then I got a BlackBerry and I noticed the downloads did happen a lot faster on Wi-Fi. That's really all that happened faster. But, you know, the point being that there's just so much, you know, power these things even have. So probably 20 megabits a second is pushing it for it to be able to even process that data.
And for those of my students listening now, didn't I tell you about this last week in class? I told you. Processor architecture and how it does its stuff.
Yeah, actually...
Got a compromise.
There's an article I read about, you know, like most computers are von Neumann architecture, and that's one of the bigger constraints is that, you know, our data access and program execution are in the same RAM. It's von Neumann instead of Harvard where they're split. And it limits the speed of the system. It's one of the downsides, you know.
Yep. It's one of the compromises they had to make to do other stuff.
Yep.
So basically what you're saying is go with the network that is still better, not faster, but like more people were on that you talk to and things like that.
I'd go with the network that has like 70% of the public covered in 4G versus like 10.
Yeah, so that changes my mind now. If the iPhone 5 is LTE on Verizon, I'm switching. I'm not
and
waiting.
I guarantee, you know, Verizon's not going to... It's not going to be LTE and this is it. They're probably going to get the enhanced LTE
They're
going to
do
advanced.
Whatever AT&T and Sprint are doing.
They did the same thing with 3G. They launched EVDO really early. It was a Rev Dash network. Then they upgraded to Rev A and all the speeds went up. AT&T does the same thing. There was less of a path to upgrade with EVDO, but you know, with LTE, there's LTE Advanced and who knows what's beyond.
Yeah, really. Yeah, maybe we can actually get a true 4G 100 megabit wireless network like LTE is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Or sorry, like the 4G spec says it's supposed to be. But our last article also comes hot on the heels of the iPhone 5 coming out. Verizon is introducing a new type of plan. So before I say what it is, I should mention that the way we all pay for phones now, the way most of us pay for phone service now, is what's called postpaid. We use our phone for a month, we do whatever we need to do, and then we get a bill in the mail with charges for what we previously did in that month. That's postpaid. That's how normal stuff works. There's also prepaid, where you pay upfront before your month starts, and you sign on for a set number of call minutes, a set number of megabytes of data, and that's all you can use. When you're done, your phone stops working until you buy another prepaid amount of stuff. Well, Verizon says, we're going to change that. We're going to start releasing prepaid plans that are unlimited, unlimited everything, talk, text, web, and it's only going to be $50. And they're doing this right in time for the next iPhone to come out. Coincidence? Hmm. Do you like this plan? Do you see any problems with it?
Well, I'm trying to decide, like, so they're basically lowering their price?
They're lowering their price. They're basically telling us you're no longer going to get a bill that, you know, lists out 5 cents for the 20 million text messages you sent because we don't care anymore. Everything is just all unlimited. Do what you want.
It just doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't make sense why they would do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't understand the switch, but I kind of like it. I don't see a problem with this. I'm paying $85 a month now for not unlimited everything. If I can pay $50 a month for unlimited everything, I'll do it.
Yeah. I don't see what's in it for them. Like, it's like...
The only thing the article said was that, you know, they don't want to make these products just for the rich, as they are now with the super expensive plans. So maybe Verizon is just trying to be nice.
Maybe they'll be like 3G only or something, no 4G or something.
That could be. It didn't say. That could be.
Because, like, I just don't understand how they could support it. You know, like one of the reasons Verizon has historically been a little more expensive is they say they invest more in their network. And I don't know, you know, if that's actually true or not. I mean, it's definitely good advertising, but, so if they cut the cost of it, you know.
Yeah. And you're going to be able to get these plans anywhere too. Best Buy, Walmart, Target, like not just from the Verizon store. So this is going to be interesting. Yeah. I would like to see, it's going to be called AT&T's name. So whenever Verizon releases this, I'll be interested to see if it's 3G only.
Hmm.
Would you buy it? $50 for 3G and
No, I mean, maybe in the meantime I might do that if I could use my existing phone or something to, you know, just to lower my monthly cost, but it depends on the limitations. And you know, I think eventually though my next phone is going to be a 4G phone. I just haven't decided what I want to get yet.
And what confuses me is that, you know, all these phone companies, Sprint, they just put a tethering cap on, you know, to 5 gigs to kind of match what everybody else is doing. All these companies we've talked about the past couple Slongcasts, they've been all about capping people and making sure they don't go over their data. And now Verizon's like, hey, you know that stuff we were trying to stop you from doing? Here you go. Like, they take away unlimited plans, and now they're giving it right back.
Yeah, it's weird.
So, yeah. I want this if it's 4G. I'm just going to say that. I really, really, really want this. So, have you seen anything else? I know there were a lot. There's a lot of stuff that happened in the past couple of weeks, but only talked about the important things.
Well, one interesting thing I saw was kind of neat last night. I saw a commercial for Google Chrome. Have you seen these?
I have seen those. Yeah.
Yeah, it was new to me. I hadn't seen that.
I had
Lady Gaga in it. And
I had a complaint about those commercials, but I forget what it was. So I don't know.
Well, the whole time I thought it was gonna. It looked like it was sort of advertising like more like Google Plus. Like, I thought it was that's they were leaning towards, like, right. Just, you know, go express yourself on and like YouTube. And then it was like at the end it was like Chrome. I mean, they show all of Google's brands, like YouTube and
right.
Google Plus and the search and everything else. But then like in the end it was like Chrome. I was like,
why are you?
Yeah.
Is Firefox gonna start coming out with TV ads now?
Yeah,
that would be cool. See a little fox flying around the screen.
I'm just laughing here at this one article with a little, you know, they have the share buttons, and there's like a share button for like Twitter, Facebook, StumbleUpon, Reddit, Dig, Delicious, Google Buzz, Google, I don't know, Google Plus, and then one with a D, and then one with a B. And one with a Q.
What in the world?
What
are those?
I'm just laughing. I'm just like, there's like, when you go to an article and there's like a million ways to share things now.
I do not do that on my site. If people want to share them, they will figure out how to copy and paste a link.
You have to hand it. I mean, I think Dig really was the first to do that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they pioneered that.
Yeah, they put their Dig button on lots of places.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, whatever. All right, so that is it for this week's edition of the Slongcast. As usual, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack, and you know, Google Plus and all those other crappy things. But And Ryan, where can people go to find out about you?
You can go to www.lancipedia.com, although I haven't updated it in ages. I need to get back into blog writing. And then also / Ryan Lancy on Twitter, which again, I haven't tweeted a whole lot lately.
That's true. You haven't. My phone hasn't dinged.
No, I haven't done a whole lot. I mean, I share a good bit on Facebook, but that's more for like friends, you know,
right,
stuff.
Not public stuff.
Yeah. I try to keep it. I just keep it to myself.
Yeah. So if you want to talk to us, you know, find some way to talk to us. You'll find us somehow. If you want us to talk about something, some awesome thing comes out and you want to hear our opinion, make sure you bookmark it on Delicious. Our next episode will be episode 43, so make sure you bookmark it with the tag Slongcast043. And that is it for this week's episode. Dovidzhenya!